to understand terror not as something inhuman or an experience that troubles one, not as something that is external, but as something that is internal. And I don't mean in the simplistic way that everybody says, I guess we all have the potential to be nasty. You know, whatever. I'm more interested in the political formation of these things, because we may all have that potential, but there are certain moments in history when it sure gets harnessed awfully vigorously into a defining force for an entire people or a civilization or a culture at that moment.
Today on Rethinking Religion, we're thinking about the subject of terror in literature and in film. How do authors and artists respond to terror and terrorism through their work? In this program, two interviews on terror and literature at the intersections of religion, culture, and public life. The first with Philip Gurevich, longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, former editor of the Paris Review, and award-winning author of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, about the 1994 Rwandan genocide, and The Ballad of Abu Ghraib, Portraits of Prisoners at Iraq's Abu Ghraib. In the second half hour, we'll speak with Academy Award-winning film producer and director Errol Morris, who collaborated with Philip Gurevich on the book and film Standard Operating Procedure.
I think of terror as it's radically destabilizing the order of the world as we know it. Telling people essentially that they are deeply, deeply unsafe in ways they probably have not even imagined. It rends the social fabric and makes you question the nature of life itself.
Stay with us for Rethinking Religion from Columbia University's Institute for Religion, Culture, and Public Life.
Rethinking religion.
I'm Norris Chumley. Following news reports of the 1994 Rwanda genocide, author and journalist Philip Gurevich became interested in what was behind the atrocities. He began visiting the African Republic of Rwanda the following year in 1995, and over the next 2 years made 9 trips to the country. His book, We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, was published in 1998, soon winning the National Book Critics Circle Award, the George Polk Award, and the Los Angeles Times Book Award, among others. More recently, Gurevich collaborated with filmmaker Errol Morris on Standard Operating Procedure, a collection of portraits of Iraqi prisoners and their American jailers, and their infamous photographs of terror and torture. As is the format and custom of Rethinking Religion, we offer a multi-perspective view on people and their ideas, and the values, traditions, and beliefs that influence them. In this episode, we offer 2 interviews with Philip Gurevich. First, in a live public forum with an audience, interviewed by Richard Locke, himself an acclaimed author and editor. Locke was Gurevich's professor of writing when he attended the master's program at Columbia in the early 1990s.
In Standard Operating Procedure, you write, "There's a constant temptation when rendering an account of history to distort reality by trying to make too much sense of it." Could you elaborate?
In order to be truthful, you've got to get at it through using your imagination. And as far as the distortion of reality by making it more real, I suppose that's a way of saying that we tend to simplify and over-tidy up our view of the world, and that there is a way in which we explain ourselves to ourselves in ways that are false in order to make it seem neat and orderly. And make too much sense of it, to come up with a theory.
You said at one point, I mean, in the first book, you said power largely consists in the ability to make others inhabit your story of their reality, even if you have to kill a lot of them to make that happen.
That comes in a chapter on the history of Rwanda and the sort of falsification of that history into kind of national myths or legends or what have you. I use those words because they're not there's twisted stories, they're deceptions, and they're propaganda. And that if you combine a very monolithic narrative structure, i.e., a government with one voice and a cowed, compliant population that is brutalized by violence to accept an account of things, they'll accept that account. There is a sense in which when you're trying to understand Rwandan history and you start to see these distortions and the creation of identities that are set against each other and the creation of two groups within that population that are actually created into mortal enemies by a sort of mixture of storytelling and violence, and storytelling and violence where the blood makes the fiction true.
Right.
Then you have to start to understand that that's what that kind of power is.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes real.
Mm-hmm.
So at the same time as you're explaining that it's constructed as a fiction, you're also explaining that it is real, and you don't want to say one or the other. To say it's a fiction is a fiction. To say it's real is to ignore that it's also a fiction. And so it's a real fiction.
Right.
That's where people are living, and that's where people are actually being killed.
Yeah, well, you say in that book at one point, genocide is an exercise in community building.
Yeah, I mean, there is a level, and I say that because it occurred to me that at some level we make this mistake in thinking of the crime and political crimes in general that involve mass violence as being equal to other kinds of crimes that are done without an ideal or
mm-hmm.
without a utopian overlay.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're obeying a political order by committing murder or extreme violence against someone, you're not committing a crime according to that political order and its laws and its rules. You are obeying its laws and its rules. You are serving its cause. And so at that point, there is the definition of some enemy, some group that is to be eliminated. It's almost always presented in genocide in particular, which is a very extreme form of this, as a purging, a cleansing, the sort of expulsion of an alien body, and the bringing together of us
mm-hmm.
by the identification and extermination of them.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in the case of Rwanda, it's actually pretty explicit, where you see that the times where violence is harnessed as a tool by the majority Hutu population throughout its post-colonial history are times not when Tutsis are getting rowdy on the edges of Hutu power, but when Hutu power, with a small p, is actually starting to deteriorate and fragment, and there's contest and struggle amongst the Hutu polity.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that you unify them is by the creation of a common enemy and the call to a common struggle.
Mm-hmm.
This is Rethinking Religion. We'll return to the public conversation shortly. In the meantime, I had a chance to ask some questions of Philip Gurevich on religion and terror at his office. In your acclaimed book, We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, you mentioned the story of Cain from Genesis, where Cain's murder of his brother is almost ignored by God, and the blood revenge model of justice is employed, which ultimately emerged as the divine law of social order. You make the point that it took many fratricidal struggles for this to come about. Why did you choose to link to the Bible?
Cain slays Abel and is made a wanderer on the earth. He is a man exiled from community. He's ostracized. Even as fratricide and the stain of murder are a heavy stigma, and the mark of Cain sits on his brow, he is not himself annihilated by having annihilated his brother, but he survives and he goes on to be the father of us all. That is the point I'm trying to make, that in this fundamental story, which our civilization has based much of its understanding of moral reality on, that's the lesson that we've told ourselves over and over. In the Rwandan instance, there's a reason I brought this up that's very specific, which is that the Bible draws on a kind of traditional peasant agrarian society and distinguishes between Cain and Abel as the pastoral one and one who is the cultivator of crops and one who is a herdsman. And the herdsman finds favor in God's sight with his offering, and the cultivator of crops does not. And the cultivator of crops kills the herdsman. And in Rwanda, the story historically is that Tutsi were cattle keepers. They were pastoralists, as it's known in the anthropological literature. They kept cattle, and they herded cattle, and they lived on cattle, and they traded cattle. And Hutu are cultivators, cultivateurs. Moi je suis cultivateur. That's what they say. And it struck me that this strange dichotomy that's at the core of the Bible's view of sort of two human alternatives in that kind of a society should have found this expression in the late 20th century, again, in a fratricidal killing. It happens that Rwanda is one of the most Christianized countries in all of Africa.
Very much so.
It is the most Catholicized country in all of Africa by percentage points.
85%.
Yeah, and so these stories would have been known to Rwandans. Whether or not that meant anything, I never make any claim that Rwandans were going around talking about Cain and Abel. But they were certainly covered by this bizarre 19th century race science that came out of the Victorian explorers, and a kind of eugenic race science in many ways that was used to categorize Hutu and Tutsi by measuring their noses and their cranial capacities. A great deal of attention was paid to the idea that physiognomy would essentially amount to racial distinction, and racial distinction was a fundamental difference in human quality. Exact same thinking, of course, that was the same science that led to the race science behind Nazism or slavery. And according to this, there was also a biblical link, which is that people assumed that Hutus were the descendants of Ham, who, according to the biblical story, or at least interpretations of the biblical story, the son of Noah, who had seen his father naked after the flood, was banished and became a black man. All of these things were part of the mix of teachings and myths and national legends and identity understandings that people in Rwanda carried, and were all mashed up together. And the whole country was run as a kind of joint venture by the Belgian colonial order and the Catholic Church, which was more devastating to the country is a matter of minor distinction, really. Probably the church.
Did the church, either Catholic or the Protestants, let the Rwandan people down? They seem to...
Oh, the Catholic Church is deeply complicit in the genocide. The Protestant Church, there isn't a Protestant church. There are some Protestant churches that had presences there. The title of the book comes from a story. We wish to inform you that tomorrow we will be killed with our families, is a phrase that comes from a letter written by Seventh-day Adventist pastors who were Tutsi to their Hutu superior, church president, in a Seventh-day Adventist area, which was actually sort of colonized by American missionaries in western Rwanda, when they learned that he was part of the group of people that were coming to kill them. So the Protestants did not distinguish themselves better, except insofar as the churches did a lot less to cover it up. I know that the Adventists have done some investigations, not entirely satisfactory, of the behavior of their ministers. The Catholic Church, on the other hand, has gone to substantial lengths to deny its role in the genocide, to some extent the reality of the genocide, and certainly to protect, reassign, and give sort of refuge to the murderers amongst its priests.
There's a lot in the book about Kibeho Hill, where it's claimed that the Virgin Mary appeared often. On Kibeho Hill, she was said to proclaim woe for Rwanda and had lurid visions of genocide. You report that later in 1994, the largest massacre was in the cathedral there, which was subsequently burned down. One priest, Pierre Ngoga, defended refugees and was killed. Another, Father Taddy, helped lead Interahamwe attacks, carried a rifle, and shot into the crowds. Church leaders were reported to frequently support the genocide. Bishop Misago told crowds of children not to worry, the police would protect them, but then looked aside when the police massacred 82 children, later claiming he was uninformed, without influence, abandoned by the West, and showed no signs of remorse whatsoever. Father Wenceslas carried a pistol instead of a Bible. You wrote that he called his own Tutsi mother a cockroach. Do you think religious leaders might actually be more prone to corruption and wickedness because of their intangible beliefs and faith or connections to the church?
Well, let's just say they're prone to self-righteousness. So that if they... I mean, there's no logical explanation by which a sentient priest can claim that he ever thought that these things were legitimately aligned with his profession of faith to God. Obviously the Christian church has been involved in bloodshed since its inception on a mass scale, but it has never been part of the Christian faith that one should practice this. And so there's a contradiction that is not unique to Rwanda, but it is certainly absurd for church fathers to claim that they did this in the name of their religion. I don't think they really did. I think that the corruption of the church, in the political corruption of the church in Rwanda, was very complicated. And I don't even pretend in the book past a point. I think that with a story as strange as this kind of killing, one has to, on the one hand, seek to understand it and explain it, and at some level, respect the mystery that you don't want to over. You cannot explain it perfectly. And I don't understand what made Bishop Misago, a guy I went on to interview, be an apologist for the genocide, a participant of some kind in the genocide, for many of these other priests to become killers, for Father Wenceslas, who later ended up in Provence taking confession from French churchgoers after he'd been scurried out of the country by the Catholic rat line. I don't understand. You know, maybe they were never religious. Maybe they were always just apparatchiks. Maybe they just saw the church as a good racket and a career. I would like to think that they were perhaps people of faith on some level, but I don't know what it means. I just don't. I mean, it doesn't seem to me that their faith was worth spit if they end up murdering their congregation in the name of a complete political lunacy. I don't get it, but there it is. And it is the story that happened over and over and over again in Rwanda.
And happening again.
It happens repeatedly around the world. Now, it's not, I mean, the important thing is, and I make that case, that there were priests who died acting the other way. And of course, because they died, we can't interview them and puff them up and present them.
The monks.
And my bet is that some of them did out of genuine humility before God. I mean, that they would have thought, as powerfully as the other one came up with some bizarre rationalization, they would have thought that this was, it was as a priest that they died, not just as somebody who was hunted. The irreligiosity of religious people does not strike me as a novelty or a kind of, but it's not my only take on them either. It's simply, this is the story that I was telling. And the Catholic Church is a political organization as well as a religious organization. And it is an organization that is bathed in crime from the beginning of time, as well as in great spiritual leadership from the beginning of time. And that is a complicated thing to reckon with.
You're listening to Rethinking Religion, our series on literature and terror, Rwandan genocide to interrogation and torture at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison, with journalist and author Philip Gurevich. Shifting now to his recent book, The Ballad of Abu Ghraib, the paperback version of Standard Operating Procedure, co-written with documentary filmmaker Errol Morris. You probably remember the horrific sets of photographs taken by American soldiers of naked prisoners on leashes made to wear female underwear on their heads, prisoners covered in excrement, and soldiers appearing gleeful next to piles of detainees.
We were holding innocent people without charges, having arrested them in mass sweeps, in bestial conditions, concentration camp conditions, and I don't mean extermination camp conditions, I mean you take a lot of people and you concentrate them at one point so they're no longer out there.
Right.
Behind barbed wire, in outdoor facilities, where they were under constant mortar fire from insurgents outside the prison walls. Prisoners were being killed, prisoners were being fed garbage. Literally, the contractors were bringing in dumpsters full of food that they sold to the occupation, because of course, we no longer actually use soldiers to do 90% of the tasks that soldiers used to do. So we hire either international contractors to do illegal things, or we hire local contractors to misserve our cause. And they were rioting, and we were using live ammunition on them. And these things struck me as, in some ways, greater outrages than some of the sort of humiliations bordering on physical torture that were captured on film, and whose shock value is largely from their kind of sexual prurience and nastiness. And I wanted to get past that, because again, the story to me is not about a couple of guards and their perverse moments on the night shift, but it's about a kind of larger political system that placed them there. Mm-hmm. And that's another reason that I draw attention, as it were, away from the photographs while circling those photographs as the evidence, because I also think the photographs have been misunderstood on one of their one really important things. But to me, it really was, these photographs performed a public service. Mm-hmm. If they were staged, if they actually didn't show the worst of it, what they did is they told us torture was happening at Abu Ghraib, and they were right. Even if what they showed us were fictional moments, it was still right. Even if a lot of quibbles could be had with what's happening in each frame, mm-hmm. so that it turns out that the naked man that Lindy England is dragging on the leash isn't really being dragged around on a leash for his sexual humiliation, but is being extracted from a cage, etc. Naked prisoners were being strung up and kept in cages at Abu Ghraib in violation of all U.S. military doctrine, standing principles, and law.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what mattered. And one had to always pull back from the kind of prurient distraction of the photographs to the actual substance at the core of mm-hmm. those photographs.
Mm-hmm. And you once said, I felt really quite surprisingly, that evil is totally inadequate and not something that you feel should be sort of trotted out as a sort of be-all and end-all explanation for what's happening. But you also said something just immediately after that where you said what really matters is leadership.
Ideally, with good leadership, the fewest number of us will ever be put to the test of whether we behave decently under pressure or not.
Mm-hmm.
That is what political organization seems to me to be for, is to get us to a place where as few of us as possible ever get found out for actually being quite dangerous to others under pressure. Because what does history really tell us? That the great mass of Europeans lived with it, took part in it, had no problem with it. That the ordinary soldier put in a situation where at the very least they're asked to look the other way, mm-hmm. where they're not supposed to ruffle the chain of command, where the chain of command reinforces it, lives with it. They blew up our buildings. You know, they'd have cut off our heads if they took us prisoner. So that became the standard. I mean, the line I say in the book is, you know, when you're fighting terror with terror, how do you know which is which? And I think that was very much the rationale we got into as we rationalized it. But we're not far from that. We live with it. And I think one of the reasons that we should be nervous about it is that it's not an issue that's had much traction in our public life, because I think people don't mind.
Yeah. What was that extraordinary moment when one of the young women, I think it's Sabrina Harmon, says that she really felt that this was what was going on. She couldn't really cope with it herself. She didn't really feel she wanted to participate with it anymore.
I have a bad feeling about this place. The prison is called Abu Ghraib. 30,000 people were murdered here. There's a chamber where these men were hung. I'm not sure about ghosts, but it is freaky. I'm hoping to be home for Christmas or soon after. I love you. Sabrina.
She sort of felt like if she's told to do something she doesn't like, she felt maybe it was a bad form of individualism, that she was kind of saying, nah, I'd rather not. This guy named Gus, who is the guy that you may know from the photograph of Lindy England with the man at the end of the leash, the naked man at the end of what looks like a dog leash being pulled out of his cell. And these nicknames, by the way, were the nicknames that were used by the American soldiers for these Iraqis. and I don't use their Iraqi names in the book, although through prisoner number and correlation charts we were able to figure them out, because presumably these people were innocent. And why identify? There's nothing really gained by it. It's one of those kind of false or misleading facts that makes you feel like you knew something when you don't actually know something. You don't really know more about who they are. And I kind of wanted to stay inside the American heads. I wanted you to feel always that sense of them as with their prisoner names. Gus refuses to eat. He refuses clothing in this place where everybody's otherwise being forced to be stripped naked. He would always say, "I will kill you, I will kill you Americans, I will kill all the Jews, I will kill all the Americans." And they thought he was some big Al-Qaeda guy or maybe an old Ba'athist heavy from Saddam's interior security forces, until they found out that he was actually just a local town drunk who'd been picked up and thrown onto the back of an American military truck. But he just didn't like being in captivity very much. And they had to force feed him with IV bags. He was really on a complete hunger strike, effectively. And they panicked about this. At one point, they loaded him into the back of an ambulance where they and so he said, "I'll eat if you take me to Baghdad. I want to be taken to Baghdad." So they drove him all around the prison yard for about half an hour to a hospital that was about 20 feet from the prison cell, and let him out and said, "You're in Baghdad." And he started to eat. And then the doctor said, "Why is this guy here?" and returned him to the prison, at which point he didn't trust them very much anymore. And you know, he would always say, "I refuse." And there was this one guy, Hydro Joyner, who was mostly kind of a clowning interview. In his interview, he clowned a lot. But he just kept saying, "I refuse, I refuse," as he quoted him. And I thought, he's Bartleby. I mean, he's Bartleby who says, "I would prefer not to," and winds up in the tombs, and "I would prefer not to, I would prefer not to." At one point I say, this prisoner, you know, maybe he's the only truly free man at Abu Ghraib, because he's the only guy who in some way is refusing the order of the place. And I say, we all made our accommodations. And at that point, I do this little "we," I think it's the second or third last line, but to include us way beyond the place, who really didn't even have anything to do with it at the time. And he refused. Bartleby died. That great story of Melville's is really the original work of what now is known as dissident literature.
Right.
He died in the tombs. And, Melville had a better last line. What can I say? Alas, Bartleby, alas, humanity.
Right.
Now, back to my interview with Philip Gurevich in his office.
Does religion enter into American policy, evidenced by the behavior of American military officials who gave directives to use religious beliefs and values to make the abuse stronger or more effective?
No, look, I think that the occupation of Iraq and the war on terror in general and the tactics that were used were based in a profound ignorance of the enemy. If we had substantial knowledge of the enemy, we would have been more subtle with the enemy. But we had very primitive and caricaturish views of who they were. And we vilified Muslim or Islamic practice or behavior even as we sort of saw it as something that we could, you know, harness their weak spots. But I don't think that there was a real understanding there. Were Christian values brought to bear? Well, obviously, I don't think there are a lot of people who claim to have a grasp of Christian values who would describe the behavior at Abu Ghraib as being particularly Christian.
No.
Was Christian rhetoric entangled in it? Yeah, sure. The Bush administration uses a lot of Christian rhetoric. I mean, it was not a great move to call this whole thing a crusade in the first days of after September 11th. And it's obvious that on one level, that word has a has this kind of secular usage that we're all familiar with as just a kind of zealous battle. A crusade just means a mission, a big mission in our vernacular. But in the international world, it doesn't. And it didn't help that we had a lot of people walking around saying, "Oh, they're trying to reestablish a caliphate and we're going to do this and that." Because what we basically did is, it seems to me, we continuously played into the hands of a certain kind of bin Laden or Al-Qaeda-ish rhetoric. We did everything they wanted us to do. They would say, they're having a crusade, and we would go have a crusade. They would say, You know, they would set the terms and we would accept their terms rather than rejecting their terms and saying, you know, this is actually the manipulation of a population with nationalist and religious ideas that doesn't really correspond to their motivations and their responses for the most part. There are obviously some religious zealots mixed in, but try to sort them out.
Mm. Probably not about religion at all, but about an entirely different agenda altogether that wasn't so publicized.
Well, it was about a certain kind of dehumanization, but the problem is that at Abu Ghraib, they didn't know who these people were. They literally did not know who the prisoners were a great deal of the time. They had it wrong. So they would, you know, if you're going to go and target somebody's religion, it would help to know who he was.
Indeed it would.
And how he feels about his religion. So if you just generically sort of take him on as some kind of Muslim, and presume that you know where that puts him and how he stands on it, maybe you're making a fundamentalist out of him, where he wasn't.
You mentioned in the conversation, when we're fighting terror with terror, we need to look much closer. It's important to know which terrorist side we're coming from.
Well, what I say is, when you fight terror with terror, how do you know which is which?
You don't always, do you?
Well, you don't want to adopt the tactics of your enemy as your own.
Author Philip Gurevich on his collaborative book, Standard Operating Procedure, with producer-director Errol Morris, who I had a chance to speak with the other day in his Boston office by telephone.
In this particular episode of our series, Rethinking Religion, we're focusing on literature and terror. Literature is broadly defined not just as the printed word or text, but also the literature of film. What would you say your definition of terrorism might be? Or terror? Or power, even?
I think of terror as it's radically destabilizing the order of the world as we know it, of telling people essentially that they are deeply, deeply unsafe in ways they probably have not even imagined. It rends the social fabric and makes you question the nature of life itself. You know, we know that the various acts of terrorism in the United States, whether it was in Oklahoma or in New York, were radically destabilizing. People were confused, angry, upset, uncertain. And you could go on and on and on with a whole series of adjectives. But the main idea is to disrupt everything. Mm-hmm. You know, if life is going on in a complacent, ordinary way, it's to take that and to destroy it, so that things that you take for granted no longer can be taken for granted, can no longer be depended on. For many people, myself including, one of the most appalling things about the war in Iraq, and this to me is completely independent of the question of should Saddam Hussein been removed from government? You know, was Iraq a rogue state? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We know that the way in which the war was prosecuted destabilized an entire country, created chaos, and opened the door for instabilities of every kind that you could imagine. Terrorism, of course, being part of it. Um, whether you label the actual act of doing it in the first place terroristic.
Or the threat.
Or the threat terroristic. Or whether you simply label things that occurred as a result of what we did. It really comes down to the same damn thing of destabilizing a world. And that, maybe this is the activist part of me. I remember I was in Paris when the missiles were raining down on Baghdad. And I kept thinking, good God, this is a capital. What if they were just raining missiles down on Paris? Mm-hmm. This is a capital where millions and millions of people live. They have their homes, they have their families, they have their lives. How can we do such a thing? And those feelings really haven't changed very much over the years. I would say that I am as appalled now as I was then. Mm.
Philip Gurevich said in our interview, it's useful to be pissed off while writing or experience some kind of heat behind a topic. Do you agree?
Well, how could you avoid being pissed off? I mean, the whole idea of equanimity and of balance strikes me as nonsense talk. You're turning me into an activist. Look what you're doing right now. Because I was overwhelmed by all kinds of thoughts. I mean, it's not over with. We talk about it as though it's in the past tense, but that in itself is delusional thinking as well.
Still ongoing.
I was outraged by many, 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 many things. Part of the problem that I had, and this may not be appropriate for your radio show, and you can tell me if I'm off base here.
Okay.
Philip was, of course, interested in what happened in Abu Ghraib. I was interested in what happened at Abu Ghraib, but I was interested in another question. And the question is how Abu Ghraib and the photographs that were taken at Abu Ghraib were used to manipulate and to manage public opinion. That endlessly fascinated me. Perhaps because a lot of the issues of the war seemed to me not controversial. You know, was the Bush administration complicit in a criminal war? Yes. Did I particularly want to make yet one more movie about that fact? No. Not because I don't believe it, but because I think there are other things to be said, things that interested me. Mm-hmm.
The fact that the photographs of abuses and torture at Abu Ghraib were released in the media, who were they released by and to what end, what purpose? Were you able to ever really know?
I pretty much know, yes. I truly believe, by the way, in unintended consequences. One can do things without knowing for sure what the consequences of those actions or those decisions are going to be. The public at large still is deeply confused about the photographs, what they mean, what they depict, how they were released. They're confused about almost everything. Or let's just put it this way. They have very strong beliefs about almost everything that may be just wrong, completely wrong.
What sort of beliefs?
The Army never had any interest in releasing those photographs.
Yep, one would not think.
They were turned over to CID by Joseph Darby. In my view, CID was already aware of their existence. All they were concerned with was suppressing those photographs. And if they had their way, those photographs would never have been seen by anyone. But there were two ways that the photographs got out, and none of them had anything to do really with Joseph Darby or with the military. No one wanted those photographs to be seen in the military. But once they were out, they were able to spin the photographs to their advantage. And I find that truly interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That by making Darby the hero, we could then in turn make the various defendants, Sabrina Harmon, Lindy England, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
He could make them the master criminals.
Mm-hmm. The Fall Guys.
The Fall Guys. I have this argument, I call it Errol Morris's perverse argument about the election in 2004. But my argument, quite simply, is that the Abu Ghraib photographs facilitated Bush's re-election, because it deflected attention from the administration and focused attention on these soldiers.
When I was in the brig, every single woman there was in that brig because of a man. Different reasons, yes, but it was because of a man. And when you join the military, no matter what anybody says, it's a man's world.
They sleep 1 hour, stay up for 1 hour, then sleep 1 hour. This goes on for 72 hours. It's sad. Pictures were taken. You have to see them. A sandbag was put over their heads while it was soaked in hot sauce. Okay, that's bad. But these guys have info. We are trying to get them to talk. That's all.
One of the amazing things about Sabrina Harmon in my movie, people don't quite get it. They have a need to see it one way, and so they just refuse to see it in any other way. They will return to the fact of her glee at torture, despite the fact that she wrote letters to her girlfriend telling her that she was disturbed by what she was seeing.
Mm, which you include in the film.
That's what my film is about. The focus, ultimately, really should be on the policies that led to this kind of stuff, the corruption of military values, the debasement of military service, the flagrant disregard for humanitarian conventions.
Yes.
And this is something that was not created by Lindy England and Sabrina Harmon.
No, it came from much higher.
Yes, indeed.
Yep.
I'm put in this very odd position whenever I speak about Abu Ghraib, because what people want you to do and what you were yourself doing is you're telling me how disgraceful, how disgusting, how debased this place was. And you're absolutely correct. It was.
Yeah.
It was a de facto concentration camp run by Americans,
right,
in the middle of the Sunni Triangle.
Yeah.
But if you're asking me also to be outraged by Lindy England and Sabrina Harmon, I simply am not. people have said that somehow because I try to examine the details of how these photographs were taken, that I'm condoning torture, which is hogwash.
Really? People say that?
I've heard someone say that.
That's a shock.
Just on the record, I do not condone torture.
That's pretty clear. If anyone watches your movie, I think that's pretty clear.
What I'm aware of is that Sabrina Harmon found the body of a man who had been killed by the CIA. She was bothered by the fact. What she wrestled with is truly an interesting story. It just shows you how complex things are for an individual human being when confronted by evil. They don't talk to me about how debased, how criminal, how vile she was. They talk to me about the common soldier and this odd position that they found themselves in at Abu Ghraib. What I remind myself of repeatedly is that there were all kinds of higher-ups who knew about this murder and participated in a cover-up. And no one cares. No one cares.
Certainly no one in a position of power appears to care.
I mean, it's really across the board. It's like none of the officers at Abu Ghraib. It's all somehow not relevant to them and to their job. I needed to make this movie, and I still think about it. I think that the issues are very, very complex. How photography can be used in propaganda. How that attention can be deflected through photography and propaganda from the real central issues at stake.
And finally, how would you describe the project of Standard Operating Procedure working with Philip Gravage?
The great thing about the collaboration is that it gave someone to me who was as involved as I was. It was someone to talk about the material, to discuss the material, to reflect on the material, and that's invaluable. I think that we contributed to each other's works in many, many, many different ways. Ultimately, Philip wrote that book, and I made that movie, and we have only ourselves ultimately to blame. But were there endless discussions, fruitful discussions, interesting discussions along the way? Absolutely.
And what's the outcome of the film? Any enigmas or riddles explained?
I'm grateful for the opportunity to reflect on film and photography and to tell a story which otherwise might not have ever been told, to tell a story about Sabrina Harmon, Megan Ambuel, and these other soldiers who found themselves there. Because I think it's an important story.
Finally, I asked Philip Gurevich his thoughts on terror, religion, and literature.
Do you suppose it's possible we might fight terrorism or prevent terrorism with ethics, values, or religious beliefs? Or is that just idealistic?
No, of course it's not idealistic. I mean, I think that I don't really think it would be religious beliefs. I think we do it by presenting what America's greatest strength is, which is a secular idea of citizenship as a civic and political construction that is available to anybody who subscribes to our concept of citizenship. It is, on a very important level, also a global struggle for public opinion. And in that respect, the values that one projects, which are political, civil, legal values, respect for a certain kind of rule of law, for due process, for habeas corpus, for innocent until proven guilty, for not using torture, for respect for the individual body, for treating the enemy as an honorable adversary rather than as a criminal vermin. All of these things can have a tremendous advantage because all of those things in their reverse become recruiting tools. Because what we are doing is we're dealing with people who are selling humiliation as the cause against which they're fighting. And we are using humiliation against them when in fact it's not working very well, has it?
Rethinking religion.
Rethinking Religion is a project of Columbia University's Institute for Religion, Culture, and Public Life in New York City. To hear the entire unedited interviews with Philip Gurevich and Errol Morris, as well as a short summary edition, and for transcripts, visit our website at ircpl.org. Many of our programs are recorded live in New York City. We invite you to join us. Details at ircpl.org. We thank Sony Pictures Classics for permission to feature sound clips from the Motion Picture Standard Operating Procedure, available on DVD and by download. I'm Norris J. Chumley for Rethinking Religion.